The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Folks, this is the Eric Metaxas Show. As you know, I love talking about science with people who know more about science than I do. That's a lot of people. We have Dr. Stephen Meyer with us today, who has a new book out called The Return of the God Hypothesis. Stephen Meyer, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, as always, Eric.
Listen, the book, I've known about this book for a long time. I read an early version of it. Just the title gets me excited. Tell people who know nothing about this. I mean, first of all, I will simply say that you've written many books and you're with the Discovery Institute up in Seattle. You're one of the proponents of the intelligent design movement. This book, The Return of the Hypothesis, has been on your heart, so to speak, for a long time. So tell us the nutshell version of what is this book and why you wrote this book now. And it's brand new. It's just out.
Right. Well, the book tells a big story. It tells the story, first, of the rise of modern science in a Judeo-Christian milieu in Western Europe between, say, 1300 and 1750, especially in the period of time about 1500 to 1750 that scientists call, or that historians of science call, the scientific revolution. We've heard from our new atheist friends on the other side of the argument that science and religion have always been at war, especially science and Christianity. But in fact, it was Christianity and the Judeo-Christian assumptions that came out of, in part, the Hebrew Bible and in part out of late medieval Catholic theology and Reformed theology that gave rise to modern science. Ideas like the
I just want to say that this is such a headline. This is such a headline. It should be the headline of what you and I are talking about right now. I mean, for this video we're making and for the radio program, the headline should be Christian faith gave us science, period. Christian faith gave us science. I know this, and I'm putting it in my book, which is coming out in the fall, but I know it in part because of you and because of the book that you have coming out right now called The Return of the God Hypothesis. I also got it from Nancy Piercy and Charles Thaxton, who wrote about it 20 years ago. But it is so open and shut, Stephen. This is what blows my mind. There is no question that you documented in your book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. There's no question that science came out directly of Christian faith. There's no doubt about it. The only question is, why and how, and that's what you talk about in the book. So let's get into that a little bit. Tell us why the scientific world as we know it, the scientific revolution, came out of the Christian faith.
Absolutely. And thanks for not letting me bury the lead here. I mean, it really is a big story, and historians of science know this story and tell it. It's very well documented by leading historians of science. And you can tell by the metaphors that the early scientists used as they describe nature. They talk about nature as a book. There's a book of scripture, there's a book of nature, and God reveals himself in both books. They talked about nature as a great mechanism, a clock that had been designed by the great artificer who had put all the mechanisms in place to give us an orderly world. They talked about the laws of nature, understanding laws. The idea of the laws of nature was, as one historian of science puts it, a juridical metaphor of theological origin. There are laws in nature because there is a divine lawgiver. And they had also a crucial watchword, and that was intelligibility. The early scientists thought that we could understand nature, understand its rationality, its order, its design, because it had been made by a rational creator who had in turn made us and endowed us with the same rationality that he had built into the universe so that we could understand the universe. There was a principle of correlation there.
Okay, but before you go on, let me just say that what you're saying about the Christian God and about the biblical God, that is not normal. In other words, it's unique to the Bible. And when you look at other religions, when you look at even the ancient Greeks, when you look at the Chinese, when you look at the Muslim world, they all had advanced civilizations, but none of them had the theology that we get in Western Christendom in the 14th century, in the 15th century, and so on. They didn't have that theology, so they didn't give the world science as we know it. Christendom did.
Excellent. Very well put. There's a great Cambridge historian, Herbert Butterfield, who said that to get science going, there needed to be not just the material necessities of science. They existed in many advanced cultures, and there were many advanced and sophisticated cultures, the Romans, the Chinese, the Islamic world. But there needed to be a transposition of thinking. And that, he said, came with this Judeo-Christian worldview of seeing nature not only as orderly, but as being endowed with an order that was impressed on it by a creator. The Greeks believed in an orderly world, but they thought that the order was intrinsic. There was a kind of logical necessity to the order. So they believed in something called the logos. And they thought because nature was had to be logical, that they could understand it doing armchair philosophy, kind of sitting back and just reasoning, how should things be? And they came up with ideas like, well, all the orbits must be circular because the circle is the most perfect motion. Robert Boyle said, it's not the job of the natural philosopher, the scientist, to think about what God must have done, but rather to go and look and see what he did do. And so the idea that nature has a contingent order, an order that was impressed upon it by its creator, it might be with gravitation, it might be an inverse square law, an inverse cube law, it might not be an inverse law at all. You have to go look and see what type of order was impressed upon nature. And so historians of science credit Christianity and really the Judeo-Christian tradition, going back to the Hebrew Bible as well, as the source of that idea that nature was created with an order, but an order that was determined by God, not by what seemed most logical to us.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, God is logical, but his logic is way beyond, for example, Aristotle, right? I mean, Aristotle was brilliant. So he says, okay, it's obvious an orderly God or an orderly universe would give us planets that travel in perfect circles, and every planet and every sun or whatever it is, they have to be perfect spheres. And yet reality is different from that. But it's not illogical. It's not like a sloppy God, right? It's just that God's order is far higher than the order of Aristotle. And people kind of got stuck in Aristotle.
Well, and there, what I used to say to my students was there are many ways to skin a cat. I used to use the illustration, not for skinning cats, but of painters with lots of different paintbrushes. And you'd use a different paintbrush for different applications. So we could infer, you know, we could, based on Aristotle's logic, think, well, we're going to need something like a paintbrush. We're going to need something like gravity to hold the universe together. But gravity could come in lots of different forms. It could be very strong, very weak. It could have different mathematical expressions. And so what the early scientists in the period of the scientific revolution realized is that they couldn't just deduce the form of gravity or any other natural phenomena. They had to go carefully look to see what type of order was there, what type of paintbrush was actually used to make the masterpiece of creation, if you will.
Well, I find it all funny and delightful because this is the precise opposite of what we've been hearing in our lifetimes. In our lifetimes, as you said earlier, we've been hearing that somehow science and faith are enemies. And what we're discovering is literally the opposite. Faith in the Bible led to science as we know it. This is a blockbuster headline. You talk about it in your book. I mentioned Charles Thaxton and Nancy Piercy. They talked about it in their
Soul
book,
of Science.
Soul of Science, about 22 years ago. Yep. This is huge stuff. And we live in a world where almost no one knows this, which is why I get so excited about your book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. I mean, this is monumental. This is paradigm shifting.
And the title of the book is meant to invite a story. And the story is the rise of modern science in a theistic context. But then also, if the God hypothesis is returning, that implies that that perspective was lost. And indeed, it was during the late 19th century, early 20th century. It became kind of the default way of thinking, to think that nature was eternal and self-existent. In other words, a naturalistic or materialistic worldview replaced the theistic worldview with figures like Darwin, Marx, Freud, Huxley, and many others in the late 19th century. That became the default way of thinking about nature and about science during much of the 20th century. But the argument of the book is that that initial theistic perspective is now beginning to come back, not in spite of, but because of scientific discoveries, especially about biological and cosmological origins.
Okay, we're going to come back. We're going to keep talking to Stephen Meyer until he runs out of the room. So we're going to talk as long as we can. Do not go away, folks. The Return of the God Hypothesis is the book. Hey there, folks. How many years have I been telling you about Relief Factor? What, like four? The truth is, I know there are millions of people, in fact, some say over 100 million people struggling with some kind of pain, maybe from exercise, just getting older. That could do it, getting older, which is why I am so impressed with Pete and Seth Talbot. They are on a mission. You rarely see this kind of focus and commitment. Seriously, they recently shared with me that they are doubling down and want to literally double their total number of happy customers in the next year. And I believe they'll do it. So here's the deal. If you're struggling with back, neck, shoulder, hip, or knee pain, even general muscle aches and pains, then I'm suggesting you order their 3-week quick start, still discounted to only $19.95, about a dollar a day to see if we can get you out of pain too. And then after that, less than the cost of a cup of coffee a day to stay out of pain. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com, 800-500-8384. I use it. It works. Check it out. Hey folks, Eric Metaxas here. Like you, I am sick of hearing about big tech companies spying on their customers, selling their data, and not being able to keep their platforms safe and secure. Luckily, I've found SquadPod, a private platform that helps businesses, organizations, churches, and nonprofits take back control of their communication. SquadPod has three things going for it that other companies do not. First, SquadPod puts you in control of who is a part of your team, what they see, and how they interact with the group. Second, SquadPod is 100% owned and operated in the United States. Third, SquadPod is simple to use. Just create an account, invite your team, and start communicating via their secure video and messaging features. Learn more at squadpod.com/Eric. That's squadpod.com/Eric. Let me say it again, squadpod.com/Eric. Check it out.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me.
Girl, you just folks, I'm talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer. The new book, the old book is Signature in the Cell. There are many wonderful books, but the new one is called Return of the God Hypothesis. Stephen, in the book, you make a number of kind of huge statements that You back them up magnificently, so there's no doubt. This is not some theory. It's just clear. But in a lot of ways, it's an issue of, how do I put it? It's an issue of getting the word out. In other words, everything you write about in the book has been true for a long time. It's not that there are any really particularly new things. It's just that the conversation is shifting. And why is the conversation shifting? Why are we talking about this now, whereas, you know, 50 years ago, everybody acted as though faith is the enemy of science?
Well, I talk about three big discoveries that have occurred in the last century. The first is the discovery that, as best we can tell, the universe had a beginning. The second is that the universe has been finely tuned for life since or from the beginning. And then thirdly, that there is the discovery of the digital code, the information and information processing systems that are at the foundation of life and even the very simplest living cells, that there have been big bursts of information into our biosphere. Now, all of these discoveries have been known for some time, 100 years or so in cosmology, 50 years or so in physics. And the biological things have been known since the molecular biological revolution. But more and more scientists are beginning to appreciate the inability to explain those discoveries on the basis of strictly materialistic hypotheses. Attempts to circumvent the Big Bang theory with ideas like the steady state or the oscillating universe have one by one progressively fallen to the wayside. Attempts to explain the fine tuning by something called the multiverse is, I think, increasingly seen as implausible by many scientists and many physicists. And the depth of our understanding of the complexity, the informational complexity, present in living organisms. We just continue to discover more and more about that. So
okay, so we've got three things here. I want to cover these each in more depth. First, we talk about the Big Bang. We talk about the fine-tuned universe, and then we talk about, I guess, abiogenesis and the complexity of cells and that kind of thing. So let's go to the Big Bang first. Basically, we've known since the beginning of the 20th century, the universe is expanding, and Father Lemaître was the first one to say it all came out of a primeval atom. But it wasn't really for sure until 1964, the Penzias-Wilson discovery of the background radiation. That's kind of when we knew that this happened. It's not just a theory anymore, but it still took a long time for the knowledge that the universe had a beginning to kind of work its way into the culture and into these conversations. A lot of people were still sticking with some of the ideas of a steady state.
There were still some significant anomalies that needed to be explained by the Big Bang theory into the early 90s. There's something called the COBE, a cosmic background explorer. They were able to resolve some of those anomalies by some of the observations they made of the cosmic background radiation. But the story of the discovery, the beginning, is just an absolutely fascinating one, because it starts with, as you mentioned, the discovery in the 1920s that the light coming from distant galaxies is being stretched out, and therefore it looks redder than it should otherwise look, an indication of longer stretched out wavelengths of light.
That was Hubble.
And even earlier, a lesser known astronomer named Vesto Slipher. And I tell the story of these guys in the book. But in addition to that, evidence from observational astronomy of galaxies receding and therefore the universe expanding, Einstein's great theory of general relativity implied a dynamic expanding universe. Einstein attempted initially to gerrymander his equations to try to avoid that conclusion, but then later, when confronted with the evidence of the redshift and the galactic expansion, acknowledged that his attempt to avoid the conclusion of the beginning was, quote, the greatest blunder of my scientific career.
And I love the fact that he said it in German, so it's translated blunder.
Blunder.
It's also been translated stupidity, the greatest stupidity of my career. So, around 1929, probably in Pasadena, I think he makes this announcement that, okay, I was wrong. But it still takes decades and decades for this to work its way through. You've got people like Fred Hoyle and others stuck on the idea that it can't be that the universe has a beginning. It's too preposterous. It's too odious. It's too annoying.
And it's so interesting how overtly philosophical the opposition to the idea of a beginning was. Hoyle acknowledged that it came right out of his scientific materialism and atheism.
Did Einstein in a way. Because it implied this kind of Christian idea of the beginning. I mean, of course, it's also Jewish, but they all felt as though the idea of the Big Bang was unscientific.
Because there was, as one later physicist, Robert Dickey, put it, an infinite universe would relieve us of the necessity of explaining the origin of matter at any finite time in the past. But conversely, if the universe has a finite beginning, if it begins a finite time ago, then you can't explain the origin of the universe by any prior matter, because there was no matter prior to the beginning of matter. And therefore, you need some sort of explanation that involves something immaterial and which transcends matter, space, time, and energy. And that sounded to an awful lot of physicists like God. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say what I think that really bothered them, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but the idea that you could go back to a point in time, 13.8 billion years ago, where the entire universe comes out of a point, of an infinitely dense, infinitely hot point. I mean, basically, that's the end of science. In other words, you go back and the laws of physics and everything breaks down. There's a moment at which the laws of physics and everything emerges. And that just bothered them, because they wanted to think, no, the laws of physics and all of this stuff has always been here. We don't like to think that there's a time where science can't go back to or before.
This was the importance of Stephen Hawking's initial work in the 1960s. As a PhD student, he was working on black hole physics. And black holes are places where the matter is so densely concentrated that it curves space so tightly, according to Einstein's theory of gravity, that not even light can get out. And Hawking began to think about, well, what happens if you back, if we back extrapolated? The universe is expanding now, but if you go backwards in time, the matter would be getting more and more densely concentrated, causing space to curve more and more tightly. And at some point, you'd reach a limiting case where the curvature of space would go to an infinite, corresponding to zero spatial volume. And at that point, called the singularity, the, as you say, the laws of physics utterly break down. And as the physicist Paul Davies has explained, beyond that point, beyond that extremity, as he puts it, no physical reasoning is possible. You can't explain the origin of the universe from physics because there's no physics before that time to do the explaining.
So you can imagine that to somebody who's who has a materialistic worldview, to go back to a point where there is no matter and therefore no science, it's confounding. And so it really bothered them. So you're putting this, the Big Bang, this is one of the three things that we're dealing with right now that points everybody to God. Whether you like it or not, science has led us to this hypothesis that there is a God. And the Big Bang is exhibit number one, I guess.
Absolutely. And also the attempts to circumvent that implication of a beginning that have come about. Hawking himself didn't like the implications of his own so-called singularity theorem. And from the 1980s on, he was attempting to explain the origin of the universe, not by reference to Einstein's theory of gravitation, which led to that singularity, but he was trying to invoke quantum physics ideas to try to explain the origin of the universe in a different way that either circumvented the beginning or could explain the universe as a consequence of the mathematical laws of quantum mechanics. And that led to a strange paradox, which itself had theistic implications, because in that depiction of the origin of the universe of matter, space, time, and energy literally comes out of a mathematical equation, something called the universal wave function. And yet both Hawking and another Russian physicist who was developing some of these same ideas noticed that was oddly philosophical, because math, as Vilenkin, as the Russian physicist, pointed out, math is something that exists in minds. And he says, before there is matter, space, time, and energy, what tablet could these mathematical laws be written on? If math is in the domain of the mind, are we really saying that the universe came out of a mind, that a mind predates the universe, as he said? So even the attempt to circumvent the idea that there was a definite beginning have led to other approaches to explaining the origin of the universe that also have theistic implications. And I get into that in quite a bit of detail in the book.
Well, this is just all so rich. I mean, because what you're saying is that they come up with this idea that, it had to be mind. And then you think, mind? What is mind? Mind is this immaterial thing that it goes beyond science. We're not talking about a brain. We're not talking about a computer. We're talking about a mind. What is a mind? So everywhere they turn, it seems, lately, they bump up against this God hypothesis, which is why you've written the book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. When we come back, folks, more with Stephen Meyer and The Return of the God Hypothesis. Hey folks, you certainly heard me talk about MyPillow and how their products have literally changed my life. Now, have you tried the pillow? They don't go flat. You can wash them, dry them as many times as you want, and they maintain their shape. They're made in the USA, and for a limited time, Mike Lindell is offering his premium MyPillows for the lowest price ever. You can get a standard queen premium MyPillow for $29.98. It's originally $69.98. That's a $40 savings. Kings are only $5 more. Remember, all MyPillow products come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Just go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener's square, and use promo code ERIC. There you'll find not only this amazing offer, but also deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the Giza Dream Bed Sheets, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, and MyPillow Towel Sets. Folks, you know I use these products, and they're fantastic. Call 800-978-3057 and use promo code ERIC. Or call 800-978-3057. Use the promo code ERIC.
Mm-hmm. Make like a Mr. Milk Toast, you'll get...
Folks, I'm talking to Stephen Meyer. Stephen, I want to go through these three things. First, we talk about the Big Bang. Then we talk about fine-tuning. Then we talk about the extreme complexity of DNA and how these things, you say in your book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, lead us inevitably and more to the idea that there's a God. Whereas 50 years ago, we didn't know some of these things. But I want to go back to 1985, when you were a young man in Dallas at this conference. Tell us what you experienced and seeing Alan Sandage on stage, because this is the moment when you began this journey and began thinking about it looks like science may be leading these top scientists to think about God. Take us back. I mean, you write about this in the book, but
I tell this story. It's been part of my story, but I attended a conference. I was a 27-year-old geophysicist. And I attended a conference that came to Dallas that was debating the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin and nature of human consciousness from a materialistic or atheistic perspective and a theistic perspective. And they had top scientists and philosophers all around the world that had been convened at this conference.
Who were some of the folks that were there? Because this is like a who's who. I mean, it was kind of
One of the astrophysicists was Donald Goldsmith, who was Carl Sagan's science advisor. Another was Owen Gingerich from Harvard University, Alan Sandage from Caltech. That was just on the cosmology panel. On the origin of life panel, you had people like Dean Kenyon, who was a leading origin of life researcher. Clifford Matthews, same. And then in the philosophical discussion of the origin of and nature of consciousness, you had people like Alvin Plantinga, and there were people across the ideological spectra as far as atheists and theists, and they were in a sense divided to debate these big issues. And I was struck as a young scientist at how the theists actually seemed to have the intellectual initiative in these discussions. It very much surprised me, having come out of an undergraduate background where you would have thought that the Christians would be eaten by the lions. It seemed to be just the opposite in this kind of conversation. And on the first panel, Sandage surprised everyone because he was a long time and well-known agnostic Jewish astronomer. And he took the panel, rose to the podium and sat with the theists, and then proceeded to explain for the first time that he had experienced a religious conversion, not in spite of, but because of the evidence from his own field. And he gave an extraordinary talk on the scientific evidence for the Big Bang theory and the discovery that the universe had a beginning. He talked a bit about the fine tuning. And then in talking about the discovery that the universe had a beginning, he said, and I had the footage of this afterwards, he was looking into the camera and he said, this is evidence that can only be described as a supernatural event. There's no way that within the confines of physics that this could have been explained or predicted. And so this was rather shaking, rather startling. And to me, it made a big impression. And then in the Origin of Life panel that followed, there were several scientists on the panel who were arguing for this new idea of intelligent design, though they called it, they said that we were seeing evidence of an intelligent cause in this digital information that was stored in DNA. And all of the panelists on the Origin of Life, in the Origin of Life discussion, acknowledged that Origin of Life research had come to an impasse. We weren't able to explain the origin of the first life from simpler non-living chemicals. Nobody really had a clue about that. And one of the big problems.
I find that funny, though, because this is 1985, yeah. Right? And here we are a zillion years later. And the more
no progress has been made on this.
It's even more than no progress. It's like the more we know, the more we know that we don't know anything. Like
the harder the problem is. Yeah.
That it doesn't work than we were even in 1985.
Yeah, and you've had Jim Tour on your program, and Tour has been reading these guys chapter and verse on the difficulties of moving from simple non-living chemicals to a functioning cell that contains digital code. And this was the problem in 85. People recognized it. It was very difficult to conceive how you could get from chemistry to a genuine code. And the panelists, Dean Kenyon, Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, on the theistic side, we're arguing that digital information in our experience is the product of intelligence. And so maybe it's time to open science to the possibility that we can detect the activity of intelligence and certain types of effects. I went on and did my PhD on origin of life biology to explore precisely that question.
Well, we've leapt to the third thing. Of course, we're talking about origin of life stuff and information theory, I guess. But so we started with the Big Bang, and you're saying again that, I mean, I'm fascinated with the way information travels. You know, in other words, somebody can discover something, but it's decades before it works its way into the popular consciousness or even into the wider scientific conversation. So the Big Bang is a huge number one. Number two is intelligent design. And then the third related is the idea of the complexity of a cell. Let's just look at that. Let's start there, because that's what you wrote your a book, A Signature in the Cell, about. What do scientists say, and we're going to run out of time here, but I just want to know, what do scientists say who are not on the page, same page we are theologically? Do they still believe that these things just happen in the primordial soup? Do they?
Mainly they're asking for more time. It's premature to infer designing intelligence from the presence of the digital information in DNA, because we just haven't figured out how undirected material processes could have done it yet. But as I argue in Signature in the Cell and in this book, we have a wealth of experience. In fact, our uniform and repeated experience, the basis of all scientific reasoning, shows us that information always comes from a mind, not from an undirected process.
We're going to be right back to continue all of this, talking to Stephen Meyer. The book is The Return of the God Hypothesis.
There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There were sand and hills.
Folks, I'm talking to Stephen Meyer. The new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. Stephen, it seems like scientists who don't want to believe in the idea that God created the first life, the first cells, they really have a strong bias. In other words, it seems to me like the evidence, even if we're not sure, would lead us to think that it was not possible in any other way. But they have a bias to natural processes. They say that it's got to be that. Anything but that is unscientific, even if the scientific evidence leads to that.
Yeah, there's a default rule of reasoning in the scientific community. It has a fancy name. It's called methodological naturalism. But the interesting thing is it's only been around since the late 19th century. And the idea of methodological naturalism is that you must explain all events and phenomena by reference to strictly natural or materialistic causes and not consider creative intelligence. Now, in most domains of science, that's perfectly sensible because we're asking questions about how one part of matter affects another part of matter, and therefore we want to give a materialistic explanation. But when we're talking about the origin of the universe or the origin of the fine-tuning of the universe, or the origin of life or new forms of life, or the nature of human consciousness, we may be dealing with a type of question that should leave us open to the idea that a mind played a role. After all, life might have arisen by undirected material processes, but a mind might have played a role. And we might be able to tell from the types of features that we find in living systems that mind did play a role. And this is the actual empirical argument I make in the book, is that we do have those types of features that are in our uniform and repeated experience, universally indicative of the prior activity of a mind. What am I talking about? Again, the digital code, the information that's stored in the DNA, and also the complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that's at work in living cells. It just is mind-boggling to people who are working in the areas of high-tech digital computing. They recognize, I had a Microsoft programmer who worked with us for a while who said, I get a feeling somebody figured all this out before us, because I see all these computer design patterns, these known ways of storing and processing information that we've recently developed in digital computing present inside the cell, indicators obviously of a master programmer, he thought, and I do too.
Well, it is wild stuff, because obviously what we're doing is we're talking about the boundaries of science, right? We're getting to those edges, the Big Bang, you know, to go 13.8 billion years ago to the moment when the universe comes into being. Science takes us to that point, but then it sort of acts as though, well, even to talk about what happened before that or how it happened or whatever. It's unscientific. We still have to be stuck in this naturalistic model, even though we're talking about the boundaries of the natural world, the boundaries of nature.
That's a great point, Eric. And we're also talking about a different kind of science, a forensic or historical science, where we're trying to infer what happened in the past from the clues that are left behind. And it's in that type of science where I think it's perfectly legitimate to consider the possibility that creative intelligence or mind may have played a role in the origin of something. If, for example, I walk into the British Museum and look at the Rosetta Stone and all those wonderful inscriptions that the archaeologists were able to decode and insisted that, well, that it can't have been a scribe. It must have been wind or erosion or some materialistic process. I'm going to miss something obvious because information we know in our experience is an indicator of intelligence. So when those archaeologists found it on the Rosetta Stone, they knew that a scribe had played a role. It wasn't just wind and erosion or chemical etching. So if we're wanting to discern what caused something to happen in the past, we've got to be open to the possibility, at least, that a mind played a role. And in these three big discoveries that I've been discussing in the book, in each case, we have good reasons to consider that intelligence or mind is the best explanation.
You talked about Alan Sandage. Because of your book, I have looked into his life, and it's really extraordinary. I mean, here's a man, he's the protege of Edwin Hubble, and he takes over Hubble's job. Tell folks about that and a little bit about his story, because it's so fascinating that this one figure, probably the leading astronomer of the 20th century, that he's the guy who makes this theological journey, and that you were there really to witness it in 1985.
And the journey is really interesting, both scientifically and theologically. Scientifically, yes, he's a PhD student of one of the colleagues of Hubble, and then a graduate assistant to Hubble. And then he takes over the research of examining the light coming from the distant galaxies. And he's able to verify that in nearly every quadrant of the night sky, the galaxies are giving evidence of this expansion. And that implies if you back up the picture, I've got a little balloon here I could blow up, blow the balloon up, the galaxies expand. But then if you back up the time clock, back extrapolate at every point in the past, they're going to be closer and closer and closer together, eventually getting back to the point where they all congeal in one point, marking the beginning of the expansion and arguably the beginning of the universe. Now, Sandage was acutely aware of this because he was the guy that did the astronomical observations to verify that those initial observations of Hubble were representative of the whole of the night sky. And so he, at a point in the early 80s, he began to really reflect on this. And he, in his talk in 1985, he explained that he realized that this pointed to the need for a cause beyond the universe, that there could be no material explanation for the origin of matter itself. And the second thing he realized was that this bothered him a great deal, that he didn't want to think about what this most likely meant. He saw this had fairly obvious theistic implications, suggested the need for a creator that would transcend the universe, but he didn't want to consider that. And that's, he said, where he really began to do business with himself, because he realized he prided himself on his scientific objectivity. His own scientific research was leading him in the direction of a conclusion that he didn't want to consider, and he had to ask himself why. What was it about himself that made him reluctant to even consider that? And he said at that point he started to do some soul searching and eventually had a religious conversion.
Well, I find it fascinating because there are so many scientists who don't do that. They really cling to the paradigm, just as the Vatican clung to the paradigm when Galileo was saying, no, please look through the telescope and you'll see that some things are different. And they didn't really want to know. They wanted to cling to the paradigm. You see this over and over with people who have power, but it's fascinating that here you have a guy like Alan Sandage. For some reason, he was willing to look past his preconceptions or his biases. We've just got 15 seconds left. Any reason why you think he was that kind of a person?
I can't speculate in Sandage's case. I just would say that it's almost a universal human tendency to cling to what we think we know, even in the face of new evidence pointing us in a different direction. So it's right. Super important that we keep our minds open to evidence says. Follow the evidence where it leads.
We're going to drag you into hour two because there is so much here. We still haven't covered it. Folks, the book is The Return of the God Hypothesis, Really exciting. Stick around. It's understood. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this segment of the Eric Metaxas Show. We've been talking to our buddy, Stephen Meyer. His new book, it's a blockbuster. And I don't mean it's been selling like a blockbuster because it just came out, but it's a big deal. The thesis that science is returning us to the God hypothesis, this is a big deal.
Yeah. It's already a musical on Broadway. So see it whenever you can take your mask off.
It's the return of the God hypothesis on ice. So let's just say this. Tonight, a lot of people are celebrating Good Friday by going to church. If you're free at 7 p.m. Eastern time, I would recommend going to sight-sound.com where you can see live the show nice. Called Jesus. It's the Sight and Sound Theater. We had Josh Enck talking about it on the program. It's just a nice way to think about the events of what happened on Good Friday and over Easter. It's just called Jesus, sight-sound.com. We should mention the film Church People. It's another Easter themed movie. It's a comedy. It's pretty kooky, I gotta say. It's starring all kinds of people that I know personally, including the man hovering behind me in the shape of a cardboard cutout, Mike Lindell, who's exhorting you to use the code Eric, no matter what.
I think the movie ends with a pillow fight and, you know, he leads it. So get ready.
We're going to write a movie. We're going to show these people how to make a movie. But Church People is the film, and you have to go to salemnow.com. Again, use the code Eric. And you know how to spell Eric, don't you? Mm. You just put your lips together and whistle. Do we have any Easter stories? I get confused by Easter every year, almost every year. I've talked about this because we celebrate Greek Orthodox Easter, and the Eastern Orthodox go by the Julian calendar, and the Western world goes by the Gregorian calendar. And so usually Easter is on different Sundays, and so the whole calendar is screwed up. Lent starts at a different time. So Greek Easter is May 2nd this year. So I'll be up in Danbury, Connecticut. We'll be celebrating Easter with our family, and yet everybody else is celebrating Easter this Sunday. And so we'll be down in Jersey with Suzanne's family. You know, we just, hey, whatever. But what are you guys doing? Yep. Anything special for Easter?
Well,
I've got six kids. Surely you're having some kind of an Easter egg hunt with the chickens or something.
Yeah, well, this is the first year we've had a bunny on Easter, so that'll be kind of fun. We'll probably, you know, I don't know, make it pose for some photos on some of the fake grass, you know.
I love bunny for Easter. Mmm, tasty. Mmm.
Well, I find that offensive. That's the microaggression against bunnies. But my wife's good with the baskets, so she does baskets for all the kids and gets things for them. So that'll be fun for them.
She's making it happen this Easter. I wrote about it in my book Fish Out of Water. When I was a kid, we lived in Queens, New York, so we'd get in the Valiant, the 1960 Valiant, and drive to Flushing Meadow Park. And this is right in the beginning of my book, obviously, because I was very young, but we drive to Flushing Meadow Park. My mother would get out of the car while we stayed in the car. My brother and I, Johnny and I, stayed in the car with my dad. And she'd say, let me see if the Easter Bunny has left anything. And she would go over to, there was a stand of pine trees. And she would come back and say, yes, the Easter Bunny has left something. We were like, oh, thank goodness. And we would run over and there are all these colored eggs and chocolate and stuff like that under the trees. And every year we really thought the Easter Bunny had done it. We never got the clue that my mother ran ahead and did it herself quickly. And after we had found all the eggs and everything like that, we'd take a walk through Flushing Meadow Park. And even like a mile into the walk, I was still looking under every bush thinking maybe the Easter Bunny left something here and somebody else didn't get it. It's a heartbreaking story. And you can read about it in Fish Out of Water, A Search for the Meaning of Life and Some Eggs early in the story.
At some point, if we get a chance, maybe at the end of hour two, I'd like to tell a funny story about my dad when I took him to see a live Easter show, and he was not doing very well. As a last,
haven't,
he only
haven't
had a
you
few.
Said enough, Albin?
No.
You never let me talk. You know what? It's Easter. I'm going to be gracious. In hour two, it's your show. Man, we're going to have some fun. We'll be back with Stephen Meyer.